Sometimes on the line, this is thecommentary.ca. The National Post calls him the funniest writer in Canada twice now. He's won the Stephen Leacock Medal for Humor. His debut novel, Happiness, was a huge bestseller, and with his brother Ian, he wrote the successful How to Be a Canadian. He also wrote the notable Why I Hate Canadians and Bastards and Boneheads. His newest novel, Spanish Fly, is set in the Great Depression as young Jack McGreery teams up with a couple of misfits, Virgil Ray and Miss Rose. They proceed through the American Southwest on a string of elaborate cons. They peddle phony aphrodisiacs, namely the 100% placebo Spanish Fly and more. The lesson, as Virgil puts it, it's not stealing when people give you their money. The book, published by Viking, retails for $32. WillFerguson.com is his website. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Will Ferguson. Good morning, Mr. Ferguson.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Pretty good, thanks. Do you think you're a funny guy? Is there a lot of pressure for you to go places like here? Or
Yeah, it's kind of like having a reputation for being a great lover, isn't it? Puts a little pressure. No, not really. I never thought of myself as a... I've only written a couple of out-and-out humor books. I've always tried to incorporate humor into stories, but I've never thought of myself as a professional humorist. Others do, though.
And not just in a professional sense as a humorist, but family and so on.
I come from a very loud, raucous Irish family. So, I mean, yeah, we're all of us. I mean, I have brothers who are incredibly funny, and my mom loved to laugh. So we grew up in a big kind of raucous kind of... There's a lot of storytelling, a lot of jokes, a lot of humor in the family. So, yeah, I mean, it's not something... I'm certainly not the black sheep of the family in any sense at all. I'm actually probably one of the more reserved ones in my family.
Let's talk about the book, and let's start at the very beginning. The photograph on the cover, This is Jack.
In my mind, that's Jack McGreery prowling the streets. It's a photograph of a tall 19-year-old boy prowling the mean streets. There's a woman behind him, who I think is Miss Rose, and they've just spotted their mark. It's a big businessman shouldering by on the other side. That's the fictional story of the photograph. The real story is, of course, much different.
Who is this?
Well, it's a friend of mine, the father of a friend of mine, Kirsten Olsen. I met her in Japan, actually, when I was living there, and she introduced me to my wife. So I've known her for years and years, and we were at her house, and this photograph is on her wall, and every time I go over, I just love the photograph. And it's actually a photograph of her father, Ralph Olsen, a farmer from Cremona, Alberta, very tall, good-looking man. He's in his 70s now, and not a grifter in any way. So that's actually a photo of a young boy in Calgary, Alberta, in front of the Hudson Bay.
Is this one of those photos that he used to have, this guy on Granville Street here in Vancouver, who you'd walk down the street and he'd have his camera there and he'd just take pictures and then he'd sell you the photo?
Exactly. The novel set in 1939, but the photo is actually from 1943. And yeah, they would take your photograph, and the novelty of photography was so compelling then, they would then sell you the photo back to you. And this street photographer in Calgary was quite ethical, but there was another type of photographer, which I found out in researching this, that would they were active in southern Alberta, and I'm sure they were active everywhere. But they would set up a very small fee, like maybe a dime or a nickel for a sitting for young women to get a glamour shot, and they would take a beautiful photo of her. And then they would turn around and say, well, it's going to cost you, $4 for the photo. And they would get all upset, and they'd say, well, I'm not going to buy it. And the photographer would then say, well, that's fine. I'm sure there are a lot of saloons who would love to have a photograph of a beautiful young girl above their bar. So the father would inevitably cough up the money and buy them out. So I didn't even realize that the story behind this, there were con men operating these street photography scams as well.
There's another photo at the back of the book.
Yep.
Of it's a boy and a woman.
Yeah, in a dust storm. And that's Jack as a young man. The book starts in the dust storms of the 1930s and talks about his mother disappearing almost into the dust and being raised alone by his dad. And that photograph in the back cover is one I came across in a history book on the Depression. I just love the photograph. It's really evocative. And that was originally the photograph on the cover of the book. But we decided it didn't kind of explain or it wasn't compelling enough as far as con men and grifters and the real story. So we put it in the back after you find out what happens to Jack, kind of after his fate is revealed at the very last pages of the novel. You turn the page and there's just this photograph of him as a young man. Of course, the photograph itself is taken in the midst of the Depression.
And you don't know who that is, or...?
No, it's a photograph. I mean, I'm sure I could have tracked it down if I had hired researchers to go to the archives. The photograph itself is from Texas, and it's just from from an oral history of the Depression, and it just, you know, mother and son in a dust storm. It was taken in Amarillo, Texas, just outside of there, during a dust storm. But no, I don't know. I don't have a personal connection to that photograph. I just love the image of it. It was so haunting.
Your friend Ralph, who's on the cover of the book, does he like the photo on the cover?
Well, it's funny because I explained to him that, and he thought he was tickled by it. He thought, yeah, sure. I asked his permission that, but I did tell him, you know, it is about con men. It is about grifters, and he thought it was quite fun. Ralph actually gave me advice. The book begins with Jack when they're on their first scam, when Jack floods the car and gets in trouble, and Ralph actually gave me advice on how you would flood a car from that era and how you would try to fix it and why that would not work. So the scene where Jack is desperately trying to get the car started before they get caught is also from Ralph Olson. He was fine with it. I checked with him so many times because I was so worried that the book would come out and he'd realize what it's about. But no, he's got a good sense of humor about it.
You live in Alberta. Where in Alberta?
In Calgary.
Why did you go to the American Southwest to set this book?
Well, actually, there's a long story about that. I've written books, a lot of books about Japan. I've written about travel and history on Japan. I've written about Canada. My next book is about Ireland, about Northern Ireland. So partly a change of pace, but also my father, the book is, the character Jack McGreery is based very loosely on my father, Jack Ferguson. And my family came out of St. Kilda Island off the Outer Hebrides in Scotland. It's a really remote island, and they, you know, poverty kind of pushed them off. They went to Glasgow, and then they shipped over to Cape Breton, which, of course, this is all in the novel, that the family comes over to Cape Breton. And so the story of Jack's father is basically blow by blow for my own family. They came over to Cape Breton, worked in the coal mines, and my grandfather, my father's father, walked away after a cave-in at the Dominion Mines in Waikokuma. And three of his brothers died in the cave-in. There were actually two brothers, but the number grew with every telling. Every time he told the story, he stuffed a few more brothers down the coal mine to make it more tragic. And he walked out, and, I mean, it's a legend, it's a family legend, but he always swore this would happen. He walked out the day of the landmine and realized he wasn't going back in the mines ever again. And he flipped a coin on whether to stay on British territory, which was as Canada was considered then, or go south and kind of pursue that larger American dream. The coin landed in Canada's favor. He found work on the CNR. He crossed the prairies. He fell in love with my grandmother from the side of a train. It was just a glimpse of red hair that he saw. And he jumped off at the next water tower, and he walked back along the tracks, you know, 10, 20, 30 miles. It grew every time he told the story. It was more, and he asked at every homestead, "I'm looking for the girl with the red hair. I'm looking for the girl with the red hair." And he found her and courted her. And they were married, and he settled in the Canadian West at the very northernmost reach of the Dust Bowl. So my father grew up in the northern reach of the Dust Bowl. But I've always wondered about the other side of the coin, you know, the history that never happened. So I wanted to write that story. And so this novel, very consciously, I put it right at the other extreme. So I put it this novel takes place at the very southernmost reach of the Dust Bowl. And the Canadian border, as you know, in the novel, it plays a very key, I don't want to give it away, but it plays a very key role. His father, being from Cape Breton, raising his kid in this Dust Bowl, and urging him, the novel set 1939 as World War II is about to boil over, and his father's urging him to go north to Canada to fight, because in 1939 the U.S. was neutral, was morally neutral. It did not take sides in the war, coming war against the Nazis. And if you wanted to fight fascism, you went to Canada. So, which I found was just fascinating, such a reversal and such a difference in the era and the mood at the time. And the novel itself is about making choices, about the fact that life forces you to make moral choices. You can't avoid moral choices. And so World War II is rushing towards you throughout the novel. And of course the novel takes the climax when everything comes to a head in the novel occurs on the very weekend when Germany invades Poland. And Jack has to make some hard choices. So it all fit perfectly with the story. I certainly don't... The location of a novel should come out of the story. You should never try to shoehorn a book into a location. It should come from the characters and from the story. And this is a perfect fit for the story I was telling.
Was your grandfather's name Jack?
Yes, actually, no, John. It was Jack. My grandfather was John, but my father was Jack. They're both Johns, but my dad went by Jack.
And
so the character Jack McGreery is based very loosely, I should stress, on my father, Jack Ferguson. Now, my grandfather did not get sucked into the... I mean, my grandfather Jack's father, which is, you know, would be roughly parallel to my grandfather, is not based on my granddad in the same way. My granddad was not as big a sucker. Jack's grandfather is a much bigger sucker in the novel. He gets set up, of course, and they take all their money. That actually came from the research into the con men. When I was trying to create this character, I found a really fascinating psychological study, a profile of con men, of confidence artists, and how they differ from the general population. So, for example, in religion, religious affiliation, they don't really vary. So the same kind of roughly ratio of religious affiliation you'd find in the general population, you find in con men. So what I was looking for was where do they deviate? And confidence artists tend to be more highly intelligent, higher IQ than the general population. They tend to have trouble with empathy. They tend to be a bit isolated. They tend to have lost a parent, either through divorce or death, at a certain age, usually at a young age, and they've usually fallen in status. So they've gone from upper middle class to middle class, or wealthy to middle class, or middle class to poor. But there's been a family falling, a bitterness. So that's when I constructed the character, I put all that into play. So Jack's lost his mother, they've fallen, his dad's lost all his money in a scheme, Jack is more intelligent, he is kind of isolated. So I kind of used that psychological profile of con men to create the character.
Besides that research, you had to do some more discerning research in terms of getting down the swagger, the attitude of the air, the vernacular.
Yeah, it was.
And how did you do that? How did you?
Well, you know, the thing is, I did a dummies book once, a Canadian history for dummies, which was exhausting. It was just an absolute. I love history anyway. I love not even Canadian history. I love Japanese history. I love Irish history. I love American history. I love Canadian history. That's kind of what I've been writing. So I've been trained to research, you know, and research and research. So when it came time to this, I just applied the same way I would research a nonfiction book. But it was much more fun because it was about con men. I was reading their bios and their life stories. These are real people, Yellow Kid Wheel and Count Lustig and Kid Dropper. So I was reading from the golden era of the con, the 20s and 30s. So it was a lot of research, but it didn't feel like work. I enjoyed it. Personally, I found the golden era more compelling and more satisfying because they really played on the victim's greed. Whereas today, cons often have this nasty edge, you know, identity theft, or they'll target senior citizens, and it's really just crime. But in its golden era, the perfect con was to set up a greedy mark who thought he was going to get something for nothing, and then turn the tables on him. They were almost little mini morality plays.
It's like that in one of the first cons that we see in the book is Miss Rose goes into a shop and, well, why don't you tell the story? She goes into the shop, she buys something.
This is a common con where they use $20 bill and they come in and claim that they're treasury men. And they promise the guy a reward if he'll cooperate, and then they take back the $20 bill. So this is a very small con, and it's called a pocket sting. And what you're doing is you're reclaiming your change. So if you buy something for $20, you get $19 change, and then you send someone else in to take back the $20 by talking them out of it. And that's why Virgil says it's not theft, because the easy way would just be to grab the $20 and run. But they don't do that. They talk them out of it, and they're always talking people out of their money. So even though it is theft, it is, in my mind, but in how Virgil justifies it, is he always says, and you mentioned this earlier, that if they hand you the money, it doesn't count as stealing. And again, not to give away the ending, but in the ending, somebody does hand all their money to somebody, and it's not really stealing at the end. I don't want to give that away, of course.
The idea of greed on the part of the shopkeeper, is that because the treasury man says to the shopkeeper, it's counterfeit?
And they dangle reward.
Dangle
reward. So he's doing this. He's going to become a hero. He's going to get a reward. He's going to get money from this. And so he's not doing this for altruistic reasons, right? They always appeal to their greed or their vanity. And that's the opening con. And they actually get more and more elaborate as the novel goes on. And they get more. And they rely more and more on the greed of their victims. And by the end of it, they're selling a money machine to a union thug. A union breaker, I should say, a union breaker, a completely illegal money machine that they convince him is real, and they take him for $50,000, and that's purely based on greed. So as the story goes on, their cons become more complex and rely more and more on greed. And I wanted that evolution. In the beginning, they're very small time. They're just small time kind of. It's the depression. There's no money. They're just thinking on their feet, and they're trying to scam a day's wages, so to speak. But the book is meant to be an evolution. Once they bring Jack in, it's Virgil and Miss Rose are a pair of con artists who are very small time. But Jack's got bigger. You know, he starts envisioning these bigger and bigger and more complicated schemes. They set up a false arrest. And then it all blows up, of course, as a novel should. There should be complications, so it all blows up, of course, in their faces at the very end.
The greed of the victims, to come back to that for just a sec, was that indicative of the Great Depression or the times of the Great Depression? Do you find that happens today even?
Well, I mean, cons and swindles happen all the time, and of course, like even the Nigerian email scam today works in the same principle. The con men ply their trade between your dreams and the reality. They peddle you dreams, and they peddle you and it works very well in the New World in North America, where we really believe that we're just one clever idea away from fortune and fame, right? We believe that. So it's an easy sell. Con men have a much easier sell here than they do in other countries. But as far as the con man himself is, I've always thought of him as a kind of a New World or American kind of iconic figure myself. But that said, we were talking about the Nigerian email scam and how it works. I'm not sure. I'm sure you're familiar with
right.
it. But you get an email that says, I'm the son or something of an exiled Nigerian diplomat. You give us the basic. There's a long song and dance, but the gist of it is, it's basically just an advance payment scheme. There's only about four or five basic patterns to a con, and this is a classic. It's an advance payment scheme. No matter what the story is, what it boils down to is, you give us money. A little bit of money up front, and we're going to give you a ton of money back. And so you give us $10,000, and we will send $3 million into your bank account, and you'll get millions. You'll get half of that. So people are their eye is so clouded with money that they don't realize they're giving somebody $10,000. And it's you see the same pattern of con again and again in all types of forms. What struck me though when I was writing this book is the cons. And these are all real cons that worked in the 20s and 30s, that worked again and again and again. And the Nigerian email scam works today, even though it's been around so long. I thought they're so outlandish. I kept wondering, why do people fall for this stuff? Because you and I, everybody likes to think we're too clever for this. But it dawned on me, the reason outlandish cons work is because they're outlandish. They're out of your frame of reference, out of your frame of context. You have nothing to compare it to. If I tried to scam you on something to do with your work, Joe, like if I said, I've got this magic email attachment that will do all your work for you, you just throw me out of my ear because it's in your frame of reference, right?
Right.
But you and I do not deal with Nigerian princes in exile daily. I'm guessing you don't. I know I don't.
I probably don't know.
So when someone comes in and tells you that this fiddle, this rare Stradivarius fiddle is worth so much, unless you're an expert in Stradivarius fiddles, it's so outlandish. You have nothing to reference it to, nothing to compare it to. So it finally dawned on me that cons work not in spite of the fact that they're outlandish. They work because they are outlandish.
In terms of mapping the book out and writing it, how long did it take you to write it, incidentally?
I usually block out a year of my life for a book. That's kind of my standard. Sometimes books are done quicker, some take longer. But yeah, I spent a year basically working on it, and then you send it into editorial. So I can't spend much more time than that because I start to get bored with the topic. And I find that, I know one of my earlier books took me 2 years, and by the end of it, I was just tired of it. I don't know how, I read about authors that spend 8 years, I don't know how they do it. I admire that type of focus because I find about a year is about as much as I can devote my focus and all my energy and my enthusiasm on. And if you're going through your second Christmas with this book on your mind, I don't know how people do it. I really don't know how, because I always start off in a big burst of energy, and I love the research, and I get the first draft down, and then you do the second draft, and you get to the editor. By the time the book is being copy edited, I'm thoroughly kind of tired of it. That makes sense.
And you spend your year full time. You're working on it.
Yeah, I'm just a full time writer. I don't have a day job, so it makes it easier. I don't juggle it. I don't write a newspaper column, or I don't teach courses. I don't teach night courses to writers at to community college. I don't do, you know, I don't do anything like that. I've been working full-time as a writer for 10 years now, so it's a job, and you block it out like a job, and you work certain hours. I still work much less. I used to be a teacher way back. I taught high school 14 years ago, way back when I was in my 20s, and I still work fewer hours now than I did as a teacher. I just block it out better, and work a couple hours in the morning, then I take a long lunch and fiddle around with my email, and then I don't have email. One of the tricks, too, is I don't have email in my office. I don't have internet or phone or anything in my office because I'll never get anything done. So I, if I want to check email, I have to go home, back to the house and check in and stuff. So that helps me to focus. I walk into my office. But, no, I treat it like a vocation because it is a vocation, and it allows me just to focus on it. If you've got a year to write a book and you don't have another job that you're juggling, there's no reason you shouldn't be able to do it, I don't think.
And when you, in that year that you're writing a book, do you work on other projects, other books?
No, I can't. I know some people can, and I wish I could. I mean, sometimes you daydream. You tend to drift towards the next, when you get kind of tired of, you start to drift. Well, maybe I'll, so your mind is always kind of, and I will do the occasional freelance article, but only when editors approach me. Like, I don't pitch stuff anymore, just because I focus too much on the book, and I find it's distracting to try to juggle two projects. Although I do admit there's times, like I say, you daydream and you'll spend a day kind of fiddling around with another idea. So I always have an idea what's coming. I always know the next book, kind of what I'm going to work on next. But I try to focus on one book. I find it gets easier and easier as I go along to realize, okay, I've got a year. I'm going to turn in a final draft a year from now, and then I'll move on. It makes it easier.
The book is so vivid in reading. You see these characters. I guess the photo on the cover helps a little bit. But you studied film at York. Did that inspire the way you've written this book, that you can write so visual?
I'm sure it has, because my only training as an author is screenwriting. I wasn't an English major. I've never taken a creative writing course. I've never taken a writing workshop. I've never done any of that. But I did study screenwriting. And screenwriting is about two things. It's about structure and visual shorthand, and that was really great training. It's not conscious. I don't sit down and say I'm going to write a screenplay, but that's where my training is. So I structure, I plot it out, and I try to convey as much as I can visually on the page. So I'm sure that screenwriting was a huge influence. I hope so. I really admire screenwriting as a craft. It's an incredible talent if you can do it. I unfortunately never was quite able to pull that off.
We have authors. We're having a lot of authors on this week, as you realize, with the Writers Festival. I always ask writers whenever I have them on, fiction writers especially, novelists, how important it is for them to read because they're writers. Do you read a lot?
Well, here's the odd thing. I'm moving more towards fiction and travel than nonfiction history. And I'm not, I tend to write what I don't read, if that makes sense. And it's a real test, is if someone said to you, you can only read or write, what would you do? And I prefer reading history than writing history. And that was a real epiphany for me when I realized that maybe I should be moving away from that. Because I love reading nonfiction, I love reading history. I like reading it more than writing it. And with fiction, it's the exact opposite. I enjoy writing fiction more than reading it. And I thought, well, you should really go where what you enjoy doing. And sometimes I suspect with authors, especially ones who are kind of blocked or don't write much or don't produce much, I sometimes suspect that they're really, in their heart of hearts, they're readers than writers. And if I had to choose between writing and reading, I would take writing.
And you're working on a book, you said, on Ireland?
Yeah, Northern Ireland. That's my next, just now kind of getting in gear for that.
That's not a novel, right?
No, this is a nonfiction book about my mother's side of the family out of Belfast, and a trip I took to Northern Ireland. I did 2 months, and I hiked all around the counties of Northern Ireland, from Belfast up Antrim and then down to Derry and Fermanagh and Enniskillen. So it's just about that, the hike I took compared with my grandfather, who was a Barnardo orphan who came over from Belfast. It's a travel book. My dream or my goal is to alternate between a novel and a travel book. Novel, travel. That's what I would like to do. So that, because you use different types, sides of your brain. I find that, I have a sister who sculpts, is a sculptor, And there's two types of sculpting. There's constructive and destructive, and you can take a block of stone and reduce it to a shape, or you can build up from clay. And I think fiction is clay. You build up. You start with an idea or a character, or even just a snippet of dialogue, and you build something. Whereas travel, you have this huge experience, all these notes, all this possibility, all this stuff to write about, and you have to reduce it. So travel writing is very reductive. You take this big mass of material and try to hone it and cut it down into something. So I like alternating between fiction and travel because you're using different techniques in writing. It's more varied. You don't get bored.
So until that book on Northern Ireland and your family, your mother's side of the family comes out, we'll read about your father's side in Spanish Fly. Will, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it, and congratulations and continued good luck with this book.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Joe. Good talking to you.
Thanks very much. The book is called Spanish Fly, published by Viking, $32. WillFerguson.com is the website. There's also a CD that accompanies the book. Tom Phillips put that together. You can probably get that at bookstores with the book as well. I'm Joseph Planta.